I am Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. Tonight begins the fall Tuesday evening season, which runs through November 19th, an extended schedule and an extraordinary lineup. It seems... Okay, I wanted to deliver this like a joke, but it's futile. I'm not going to be able to do it. I have to give Michael Opping credit with giving me this information. Anybody who knows me knows that there's no way I'd know this. But it seems fitting that we would begin on the same night at the same hour as the Mexico-U.S. soccer elimination game for the World Cup. Because, so there you go. And isn't that extraordinary? And the reason I say that is, of course, because tonight also marks the inaugural event for the museum's Mexico Inside Out Themes and Art since 1990. Mexico Inside Out is an ambitious undertaking curated by the Modern's curator, Andrea Carnes, with assistant curator Allison Hurst serving as the assistant curator of the exhibition. It opens to the public this coming Sunday, September 15th, with the members opening on Thursday, as in day after tomorrow. Members opening is special in so many ways. In one way, it includes a special 6 p.m. presentation by James Oles, who will put the exhibition in historical context with the introduction of his recently published Art and Architecture in Mexico, which is a Thames and Hudson World Art Series book, for which there will be a book signing just following the lecture. And I invite you to all come back and join us for that. This is a very layered, beautifully complex exhibition, which calls for equally engaging programming. So we are taking full advantage of the amazing talent we have in our midst, with many of the artists giving represented in the exhibition giving lectures and gallery talks. Such talent includes our own Andrea Carnes, who offers direct insight into the exhibition for next week's Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. The title of her lecture is On the Daily. I'm giving you a heads up here because I want to encourage you to visit the website and mark your calendars. Trust me, you do not want to miss any of this, and I don't want to be responsible for you not knowing. So now you know. Tonight is Case in Point. What a wonderful way to begin the season. Longtime friends Jay Oles, who has graciously agreed to be here tonight in addition to his presentation on Thursday, and one of today's most important and generous artists, Frances Elise, whose work is, of course, featured in Mexico Inside Out, are here in conversation to delve into Elise's practice, his ideas, and some specific works. James Oles is senior lecturer in art at Wellesley College, where he teaches in the spring and serves as adjunct curator of Latin American art at the Davis Museum, where, by the way, Frances Elise had a solo exhibition in 2012. Jay lives and works the rest of the year in Mexico City. He is a specialist in Latin American art, focused on modern Mexican art and architecture, which is the subject of his new book, and to be discussed Thursday night. But tonight he is here in the capacity of friend as well as scholar. Frances Elise was born in Belgium, studied architecture, and shifted his practice to art shortly after moving to Mexico in the late 1980s. He is one of the foremost artists working today, exhibiting internationally with recent exhibitions, including a major survey, Frances Elise, A Story of Deception, that traveled from the Tate Modern in 2010 to the MoMA in 2011 and received accolades from across the globe. I think many of you had the opportunity to see that exhibition. And also Documenta 13 in 2012, which was also received with great enthusiasm, and a two-part solo exhibition at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Tokyo earlier this year. Elise is appreciated for, as Mark Godfrey describes in his essay for A Story of Deception, as having one of the most compelling practices in recent art, in which he manages to find poetic and imaginative ways to address the urgent political and economic crisis of contemporary life. Francis' resume is a long and impressive read. For the sake of time, I've only mentioned three projects of many, but suffice to say, we are thrilled to have him here tonight and to have his work in this important show here at The Modern. With that, please join me in welcoming J. Olds and Francis Solis as they share their stories and insights.
Is this fine? Hi, everybody. Welcome. And it's just, it's always great. You know, you never know, well, sometimes you never know if 10 people or not are going to show up. But here they assured me that they would have pretty much a full audience. I have some opening remarks, and then we're going to look really at three discrete but also interrelated periods in Francis's work, a sort of roughly chronological move from Mexico City to Tijuana and the border, which is related to the piece that's the main piece that's included in the show upstairs. And then finally, we're going to show one clip and then a full recently finished video done in Kabul in Afghanistan, or outside of, in different parts of Afghanistan.
Two clips.
Right.
Two clips.
So it'll be two different works. So we have a lot of terrain to cover. I have a lot of things, a lot of questions. I don't think we're going to get to them all. So there is a PowerPoint. Forgive me if we just zip through some things, go backwards, forwards, and that there's a little bit of an organic flow to this conversation, although, as you can see, it's slightly slightly scripted for the sake.
It's your text.
My text. There's little places where it says prompt. So soon after I moved to Mexico City as a graduate student in 1991, I joined an alternative art space named Corare, and the name of that space was really a play on the Spanish word for I will curate. This was a curatorial project, really, but also, of course, the poison. And we formed that at a time when communication between the Mexican and foreign art history worlds, including the contemporary art area, with the communication between these two was relatively erratic and often sometimes non-existent, far less than it is today. And it was also a time when government-controlled museums and commercial galleries were far less flexible and open to experimentation and cultural critique than they are today, the early 90s. But in those days, I was just a Yale graduate student focused on Mexican art of the 20s and 30s, and I was eager to interview people like Manuel Alvarez Bravo, the photographer, and listen to his stories. And I was a little bit nerdy. I was a little skeptical about these bohemian, chain-smoking, tequila-drinking artists that were living in these semi-run-down buildings in downtown Mexico City. So I really, in the very early 90s, when I should have been super cool and knowing what was going on, I kind of was in the library. So let's see if this works. So I have no recollection of the first time that I met several of these artists, and I don't remember the exact time that I met this guy here from Belgium, who's just a couple years older than me. But I think one of the first things I remember hearing about was this guy who had wandered the streets of Copenhagen for a week in an action that is actually called narco-tourism from 1996. And the photograph on the postcard photograph on the left relates to this piece. In which each day he took a walk in the streets of Copenhagen under the effects of a different and increasingly mind-altering substance. Now, today I could discuss this action event within the career of an artist who has wandered the world, exploring the fine line between life and art, between experience and the record of that experience, between utopian goals and harsh realities. And I probably could insert his 7-day walk into a cultural history that would include 19th century druggies like Thomas de Quincey or Edgar Allan Poe, who never went to Mexico, or some 20th century guys that did, beats like Jack Kerouac or Bruce Conner. This drawing on the right is a drawing that Bruce Conner did in Mexico, possibly under the influence of mushrooms. These earlier narco-tourists, one might say. Or you could look at narco-tourism 1996 as very prescient of an issue that would become so important in Mexico in our time, really. The so-called drug war, a political and economic reality that's torn Mexico apart over the past decade. But at the time, for me, an action like that was really more of a rumor. Compelling, frightening, an act of bravery, perhaps, or foolhardiness, poorly recorded in photographs that barely circulated before the arrival of Twitter. It's no rumor to say that Francis was born in Antwerp in 1959, a fact that practically requires critics to bring up Belgium's most famous painter when talking about his own paintings. And it may be that Magritte's sense of the uncanny does affect much of Francis's work, forcing us to take a double take, to look again more closely, which is often what his work is fundamentally about anyway. Following what he describes as a peaceful and almost uneventful childhood, Francis studied architecture and then in 1986, to avoid being drafted into the Belgian army, fled to Mexico in search of volunteer work that would exempt him from military service. By 1988, he was in Mexico City, not yet perhaps an artist, but one of a wave of émigrés and long-term visitors from all over the world, really, who energized the local art scene beginning around 1986. Jimmy Durham, Michael Tracy, and Thomas Glassford from the United States, Eugenia Vargas from Chile, Juan Francisco Elso and Jose Media from Cuba, Melanie Smith from England, and Sylvia Gruner, who, although she was a Mexican, had just been educated in Jerusalem and Boston. A few years later, in the mid-90s, I remember attending a panel discussion where one irate Mexican artist who saw the content-heavy neo-Mexicanist imagery that was really popular in Mexico in the 80s being slowly displaced by a new and much more delicate neo-conceptual practice railed. He railed against the attention these foreigners were receiving in the national international stage, which was a kind of a xenophobic echo of what the muralists' attack on some foreign artists had happened in the 1950s. Now, most of those artists that I just mentioned moved on to other places, and they're now replaced by scores of international hipsters that have moved in to take their place. Sylvia Gruner remains in Mexico. Melanie, Thomas, Francis, who are all present in Inside Out, do remain in Mexico. But the intensity and freedom of that earlier moment in the 90s, when these artists were operating largely under the radar or just beyond the radar of curators and the market, although that would quickly change, would never really be repeated. It served as a rich foundation for the work they would produce in the subsequent two decades. So Terry mentioned that Francis's CV is too extensive to even begin to summarize. So what we've done is to, as I briefly mentioned, we've set up this roughly scripted, roughly informal conversation around three geographic areas among the many that this globally, quintessentially globally roving artists has worked. So first Mexico City, Tijuana and the border, and then Afghanistan. And I hope we can pull out particularly two issues, among others. One are the facts that are related to the mechanics of producing these projects, some of which are very simple and some of which are obviously far more complex. And to explore a little bit about his interest in the process of making things, of creating a statement and of telling a story. And Francis recently said to me that over time he's come to understand the power of the short story, a literary short story. And I would suggest to critics that maybe as much as Magritte or Duchamp or Bruce Nauman, that some young critic or curator might really explore Francis's relationship to a story writer like O. Henry, you know, runs along and then there's the punch, right? That line, that punchline. Fine, and so kind of go through the mechanics a little bit of these stories, and then on a more conceptual or interpretive level, some considerations about the paradox inherent in much of his work, sometimes more overtly than others, that sometimes the making of something leads to nothing, and sometimes making nothing leads to something. And by the way, we're going to show clips from some videos, but most of them are available, and many of them can be downloaded for free at francisalice.com. Okay? So, first of all, this is where Francis lives now, this plaza in downtown Mexico City, the Plaza Loreto. Now, much of Francis's work takes place within walking distance of his studio, now in an 18th century building on an only very slightly gentrified Plaza de Loreto. And in fact, he uses the city as a base of operations, an intellectual stimulus, a laboratory, both medium and support for much of his work. And we're going to start with a clip from a 1997 video, The Paradox of Praxis, in which he's pushing a block of ice down the streets of Mexico City to a soundtrack of daily noise, but without much evidence of spectators, an action so strange that it goes unnoticed by everyone except the camera. So, first question or first thing I wanted to talk about a little bit was the use of video. And, you know, you trained as an architect, and some of your earliest pieces were actions that really were only recorded in still photography. So how did you get interested kind of in video? And you know, talking a little bit, we were talking about the differences between video pieces like this and then what we're going to see at the end in terms of the changing nature of how you're dealing with film or mm-hmm. video.
Hi. I mean, first of all, just a slight correction. I mean, I didn't document so many of the actions with... can you hear me? I mean, loud enough? Sorry. I didn't record so many of the early works with photographs. I mean, some of them were recorded, but mostly I tried, if I remember well, to kind of create some images, but like some drawings and paintings that could somewhat represent the intention behind the actions that were performed in the public space. So that's, you know, not to enter into further details, but that was the base of the projects with the sign painters, was largely inspired by actions that were taking place on the street. But I was feeling that their translation into a photograph wasn't quite translating the same emotional dimension as the event itself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my access to video was just like any other route to any medium. I mean, I wasn't trained in any particular medium, so video was one of the many potential ways of recording something. I may try to kind of open up a little bit more the question in terms of the documentation of any event or action. I mean, I think it's kind of a two-part stories. I mean, a project. There's one moment where the first stage is, it's like an immediate response to a specific situation, which is what you would call the local life of a project. And then you've got a second stage, which would be what I'd call an export stage.
Mm-hmm.
That is, if you're lucky enough, that what you did at that place at that moment, addressing a certain situation or a certain community, may be exported abroad. And that's, I mean, at least in the way I treat it, is a completely different episode,
mm-hmm.
which may even mean that it's a different product. I mean, I've habitually tried to really separate the two moments, you know, the local moment and the export moment, partly on the base that you cannot pretend to recreate the intensity of the moment through the video.
Yeah.
You have to accept
yeah.
the limits of the video, and that by the moment you're willing to kind of show a documentation of it, it's you have to tell a different story sometimes.
Sure.
You know, of course, you're trying to represent the emotional intensity of the moment of the action, but you're somewhat already in a different frame of mind
mm-hmm.
and telling a different story. So it's, I mean, reenactments, which was a piece where I recreated an action twice, was partly dealing with my doubts about the, I mean, how much is it possible to actually record an event that is meant to be a performance, meaning that it's meant
right.
to be immediate, you know, totally into the present.
Well, the big difference between this and what we'll see, particularly in Afghanistan, is that those are really much, really scripted, not totally scripted, but are planned.
We'll come to that.
Bill, we'll get
no,
to
it's
that.
Partly scripted and partly improvised. It became a mix of the two.
I mean, there's some improvisation here as well, isn't there? I mean, how much?
I mean, this one was a lucky one because it had an obvious beginning and an end.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you say that the action goes unnoticed, it's because it's a very familiar action in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, it is somewhat strange that a gringo is pushing the block of ice, but out of that, it's a very common situation to encounter in that part of the city. Or, you know, it's maybe less, slightly less today, but still is mm-hmm. quite
common.
Yeah,
you still see them, yeah.
What was your question, sorry?
No. One of the things is here, you're present in this so much, you know. I think you seem to be actually more physically present as a performer, as an actor in these earlier works than many of the more recent ones, particularly the ones that we're going to look at today. I mean, you're really much more behind the camera than in front of the camera. And obviously here, you know, yes, blocks of ice are in the street, but you do not really blend in very well, given your height. Or maybe you do. You know, I mean, downtown Mexico City has a lot of strange types. Some critics have used this term flaneur to discuss your position in the modern city, and it could be Mexico City, it could be any other city. And you know, just as a trigger to deal with this concept of the aloof Parisian walking through the city, I have this painting of the Vicomte by Degas from the 1870s. You know, I know you don't just walk. You're not just walking through the city, but I wonder what you think of this word flaneur. You know, which has been used a lot, and what of your approach to a city and to what extent, say, language and familiarity matter, because obviously in Mexico City, you live there, you know the neighborhood, you feel more, you know, relatively comfortable, even if you are El Gringo, but you've worked in a lot of different cities, and often you're dumped into a city and you have to develop a project in that place. Mm-hmm. You know, what's your relate, you know, what, how do you, you know?
I mean, I think it's a double question. One is about the flaneur figure, and the other one is about walking. I mean, the use of walking as a way of production, I mean, as a mean of production, if you want. I mean, I'm not an expert, but as far as I understand, the kind of Baudelaire conception of the flaneur is a sort of, as this gentleman, aristocratic figure, getting a kick out of melting into the crowd, you know, and getting a kind of high of flowing with the movement of the city. This kind of, you know, quite romantic concept is somewhat difficult to fit within the crude reality of the city of Mexico. I mean, it's everything but the kind of place where you can just, like, let yourself flow. So I think to start with, it's there's already a sort of contradiction in between the two figures. I think also one of the key elements in the figure of the flaneur was this kind of like aimless derive, you know, which was retaken by the Situationist, etc., in a different context and with different ends. Can't quite say that, you know, the way I mean, of course, I use the I mean, it's kind of silly to say the medium or the somebody asked me what is the philosophy of walking. It just happens to be a very immediate, cheap, always available way of performing something.
Right.
And performing something while producing nothing most of the time, which is something I was interested in from early on. But this said, you know, and the Ice Piece is probably one of the best examples of it. It's not a nameless flânerie. It's a sort of, there's a certain route that is determined, even if the routing, if you want, happens along the development of the walk. You know, there's a kind of like search for some kind of response. The parameters of the walk may be very well kind of defined, but I look for some kind of outcome. Whether it's in Mexico City or in other places, well, because I'd read your text before, I refound the quote that Russell Ferguson used, which is really nice. I mean, it's a little pretentious within the context, but anyway, it's supposed to be said by Francis of Assisi, and he says, "It is no use walking anywhere to preach unless our walking is our preaching." And I think it kind of somewhat illustrates the difference in between the kind of flaneur concept and
and a more engaged,
Yeah, I mean, read it as you wish, but it's a different attitude, I think.
Okay, good, cool. I know you. I don't. I think you know you. I already showed you this one once, and I know you don't like it. I just find, you know, this relationship. I think the issue of self-portraiture is kind of interesting, and this ongoing, particularly in a painting like Rembrandt's, this ongoing issue of the artist representing the art or the process and the challenges of that. What I think is, and this is comparison, is even more, I think you forget that you're both from the Low Countries, you know, but forget that. And also forget that probably at this time you had kind of a studio that was almost as humble as his humble place. But I think what I like here is that Rembrandt is also withholding from the viewer, you know, this image that we don't see what's on the easel. And in a way, I think I think there's something about in paradox. Even we want to talk about sculpture, but you're also kind of withholding this marketable project or anything tangible. That it's just kind of, you know, there's the effort, there's the sense of engagement and intellectual, the challenge or the effort, but then it's you know, it's kind of vanishes before you or it escapes out of your hand. I don't know if you had any.
No, I mean, it's partly reflecting on what you were saying and just like giving vague kind of background to the piece itself. I mean, yes, it had to do with, you know, what later became a much, much larger kind of narrative in the work, just this kind of like concept of understanding of production as I was perceiving it in Latin America back in the context of the early 90s. But I think it had as much to do with my own kind of like attempt to build a language as you know, I wasn't that young, but I was a young artist. I just kind of stepped into that practice. So there was a lot had to do with this kind of wanting to come to terms with sculpture, in particular minimal sculpture, which was you know, a strong interest from me. I mean, listening to you, it reminds me of another, you know, it's a side point, but it's sometimes difficult, you know, to, one, revisit a project that was done, what?
Almost 20 years
ago. Not too long ago.
Yeah.
And two, you know, not being influenced by the reading that have been done by others.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, which usually I'm much more articulated than I am and have much more richer reading of the act itself. So you find yourself sometimes interpreting your own works through the reading that was given later on by other people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite a kind of, you know, talking about paradoxes, it's something that I think I need the notebooks that are private. To a certain extent, can recreate the state of mind you were in when you were actually conceiving the project. And then most often, you don't really know why you do this one morning. You just feel as this is the most kind of urgent thing to do, and ultimately that's the only thing that matters. You know, is that the?
Yeah.
I suppose that's what youth is about. You know, the arrogance of youth. You know, the sense that what you're about to do is the one thing that should be done. And after that, you can revisit those moments, but it's always going to be somewhat influenced by your, including your own life. I mean, your own kind of like hopes, deception, desires. So it's, I'm just trying to be relative about my comments. Don't take them too seriously. That's all.
No, well, I think, you know, we're going to move on to Tijuana, but I think this piece is really important to set up because we'll see kind of, I think, at the end in this really recent, this recent work done in Afghanistan, how France is kind of returning to this idea of the process and the challenge behind it. So, we turn to a project just really about a year later called The Loop, which was done in the context of Insight. One of the dramatic changes that took place in Mexico in the 90s was the increasing internationalization not only the artistic scene in Mexico City, or also of the Mexican economy, I should say, but the participation of Mexican artists in an increasingly globalized art world, shaped by both national events like art fairs and international symposia with curators and critics coming down, but also their participation outwards in that explosion of international biennials, particularly the Bienal de La Habana in Cuba, where Francis participated in 1994 and then supposed to participate in 2000, but as he told me, he had to withdraw. When what happened, dear?
My old equipment blew up when they connected it to the voltage.
220.
Cuba's got two voltages, 110 and 220, and they plugged in 220 and the whole thing blew.
And you couldn't just go out to Best Buy and buy more video equipment.
It was a bit of a short timing.
Yeah. And then Insight, which was really important in Mexico in the mid to late 90s, this network of contemporary art programs and commissioned projects on the in the San Diego-Tijuana corridor. So in 1996, I guess, you were invited to participate in Insight, and you responded with this project, The Loop, And this is really about the time I think I got to know you better. By 97, I knew you pretty well. So I wonder if you might discuss this project. This was the first time you'd worked on the border. And, you know, a little bit about the story about how you... Because I think it's kind of interesting how an artist gets invited to one of these international biennials with one idea and then another idea kind of ends
up. No, I mean, I was originally invited by Olivier Dubreuil. And my first project was a completely different project. It had to do with the chewing gum. I mean, the chewing gum as a kind of a sweet substance. I discovered that the chewing gum came from this Maya substance called zicte. And it was a local kind of pleasure. And during the Santana War, which is what,
Mexican-American War.
Yeah, Mexican-American War, precisely. Santana was the main kind of like... Mexican general?
Well, he was, general, president, too.
Yeah, president, etc. Was chewing that particular substance. As things were going worst for Mexico, better for America, if you want, his interpreter got intrigued by what he was chewing.
His U.S. interpreter.
His U.S. interpreter, yeah. And he asked him about, you know, the substance, etc., which turned out to be adding some sugar, what became chewing gum. His interpreter was actually Adams. I don't know if you here are familiar with the chewing gum Adams. They're still very popular in Mexico. I was also taking photos of, you know, chewing gum that people leave under tables, both on both sides of the border. Mm-hmm. And this was basically the project I was working on. But
it's clean.
The project itself didn't receive the support of... the board, Michael Cushman, Cartman, etc. And because it was the first time I was given a budget, and because Insight was dealing with border issues, I dropped, I think it was by email, the early stages of email, a mock project, which says, okay, fine, I'm going to spend the whole of the budget doing... circumnavigating the globe to get to the other side of the border, to basically cross the border the longest possible way. And they went straight away for it. So there was just like... And that's how I ended up doing it. So there was, again... You know.
So you proposed really this idea. So he... You know, you see here, he's leaving Tijuana June 1st, coming down all the way down through Chile. Whoops, sorry. Going down through... You know, around that, circumnavigating the whole Pacific.
It's basically the Pacific Rim,
Pacific Rim, and then coming back down, so that you really didn't physically cross the border. You just went from one side of the fence to the other.
I put an elastic rubber band or rubber around a small globe, and that's basically the route I tried to follow as close as could be. Mm-hmm. Using every single penny of the $10,000 budget we were given.
But then you sent some postcards back. Along the way, you made drawings, made some photographs.
I sent some postcards to Olivier, to the creator. But basically, the only real evidence of the project is that postcard.
Yeah.
And ultimately, which brings to another issue, I could have not have done it. You know, it's a good example of a story that, you know, can exist without the need to perform it. I mean, for ethical reasons, and because it was, you know, great fun, I did it.
Yeah.
But I could not have done it. You know, talking about
the rumor, the story, the rumor.
It could have been an example, and there's been the temptation sometimes to just leave as a rumor. Mm-hmm. You know, this or some other projects.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's a great. You had a good trip there for. And these postcards, you know, you produce these postcards for a lot of these projects, sort of as these takeaways. It's kind of, you know.
I mean, this is pre-internet days, huh? So there's no blog where you could just drop information, etc.
Right. Right.
No,
So now that takes us to rehearsal one, the video that's here. on display. And we're not going to show a clip from it because we know that every single one of you is going to be going to the opening or one of the related events around the show, and you're going to be able to see it in its entirety. It has a whole room devoted to it in the show. But could you at least just explain a little bit about the mechanics of the piece? And you're here now returning to Tijuana to do a project on your own, right? I mean, as opposed to something that's commissioned and that's almost making a joke, really, about the art world, that you can use this $10,000 to do almost anything. Here, it's a little bit more melancholy and quite a bit more serious, it seems to me. Even though there's a funny aspect to it. So could you explain a little bit?
No, I mean, the mechanics are very simple. I recorded the band in Juchitán.
Oaxaca, in the state of Oaxaca.
Rehearsing, I think it was a bolero, which is a kind of danson type of music, and went to Tijuana, rented this Volkswagen Beetle, and basically while listening to the rehearsal, I would go up while they play, and as soon as they stop playing, I start kind of like discussing the next musical phrase. I would let the car go down.
So you're driving.
Pendulum movement up and down, like an oscillation up on that kind of like straight line. So it's a very simple scenario.
No, I didn't.
I mean, the idea was to kind of create a kind of sense of always delayed time perception or always kind of like illusion of any conclusion. I mean, it's something I'd started working on with an animation, Son Fulupita, which is, you know, this kind of woman pouring water from one glass to another. And it's again, it was, you know, the doing without doing it, etc. And an attempt to kind of, you know, create a state of hypnosis in an act.
Mm-hmm. This repeated act that kind of has almost no purpose, or it has no resolution. So the car just trying to get up to the top of the hill. Mm-hmm. Can't. You're actually driving the car here?
I'm driving the car, yeah.
So what did you do? You had headphones?
Headphones. Okay. And Rafael was filming, Rafael Ortega. But I think that, you know, in a greater context, I was trying to do a kind of like a render of the time perception I had encountered in Mexico, and to some extent in Latin America. So it was this kind of attempt of recreating this sense of always delayed conclusion. I think it's probably one of the most kind of like time-encapsulated series I've been working on, because it's been quite a prolific kind of team in terms that it was addressing Latin America and Mexico at a specific moment of its history. This is pre-globalization age. This is still like the kind of period where, you know, pre-government at the time were doing successive efforts to import a kind of model of modernity.
Mm-hmm.
Imported from the kind of Truman model
of developmentalism, right?
So there were like, you know, the different. I think what I was trying to do is suggest that there were alternative models to kind of as means of production and as means of development, if you want. In my understanding at the time, the space of the attempt was in itself a space of production. This is all, you know, reading back again in the intentions behind the projects I was producing back then. I mean, you could take it as a much more atemporal piece and make allusions to more like Sisyphean effort, it just depends on how you, what angle you want to kind of.
No, but and we're, I don't think we have too much time to talk about it. There is a second piece, Politics of Rehearsal. It's a much more complicated, video. What year, Francis? I don't know, 2005, right?
2000. Soon after. Yeah.
In which, you know, he in this video is juxtaposes. Truman's inaugural address in 1948, where he introduces this idea that the role of the Western nations, particularly of the United States, the wealthy nations, is to help pull up these other poor nations out of poverty. And of course, in the context of the Cold War, the idea is to pull them out of the reach of communism, right? But this goal of being developed or of being modern is continually being frustrated, right? I mean, there's, in fact, you could go back to Mexico in the 19th century, you know. There's this model for a sort of, you know, developmental that fails in the revolution, and then you have another model put in. This cycle of crises, right? And you never really get anywhere. So, yeah, I felt that this piece, when I first watched it without, you know, I mean, I haven't studied all of your work in depth. When I first really looked at it, I really thought about it as a very personal statement about effort. Because, of course, the band that's playing is an artistic ensemble that's trying to rehearse and get the thing right. And you're somebody who works on sketches all the time and outlines and drafts and ideas and words, right? And so these things are all rehearsals, all these things that you're doing on a daily basis to get towards even, you know, the takes on a video, mm-hmm. right? To get towards some piece that theoretically could be the final result, or maybe it isn't a final result. So obviously there's a personal thing here about the process of working through an issue, working through an mm-hmm. idea, working through it with other people, collaborating, mm-hmm. which you do sometimes.
Many times the final product is only the evidence of the process that precedes it, which is the main kind of like a life of the project.
Right. Which I think is why you'll see upstairs why Francis often, you know, installs drawings there with the piece, because it's really not just academics don't do it all the time sometimes, but it's kind of trying to make transparent the difficulty of what you actually are doing, which even in, I was talking to somebody recently about wall labels and museum exhibitions and how very often they're unsigned and they're just these declarations, and you don't really see behind those labels or behind the show all the things that you didn't get, all the negotiations that you had to go through, all the financial or economic or political or personal problems, and it's all concealed behind this slick, beautiful theatrical presentation, which is often the case with artists, mm-hmm. and certainly the case with writers very, very often. So I think it's probably, but that political reading that this is also about the Volkswagen Beetle itself, a product of, you know, German engineering produced in Puebla, whatever, is this. Yes, it's making visible not only this artist's process, but also a nation's process of continually trying to move towards something and not getting there and falling back and then moving towards that. And that is continually being concealed by the governments that are telling you, no, this time the dream is real and we're going to get there. And they don't remind you that they failed so many times in the past. Okay, I want to get to Afghanistan. You know, so here's Kabul. You know, you've worked in so many incredible places. You know, Patagonia, Israel, Japan, Gibraltar. But I really wanted to conclude with Afghanistan. It's really one of the places you've been working the most recently.
Two and a half, three years.
It's not an easy place. Has anybody here been to Afghanistan? Is anybody from Afghanistan? I mean, there's probably not that many countries I could list in the world where I would get a show of zero hands in this room, you know, but I'll spare you the geography list. But Before we get to this clip, I just, how did you first go there? How did you first get involved?
I was invited by Documenta. I think Caroline wanted to develop this kind of satellite of a castle in Kabul. But there was no clear program or intention behind. It was a very open invitation. And actually, it was partly to take to participate to a panel which had to do with the issue of the reconstruction or not of the Buddhas in Bamiyan. Right. If you're familiar with the Buddhas that were dynamited by the Taliban in 2001, actually.
Right. Okay, we're going to show a clip from this 2011 video, which is called Real Unreal, R-E-E-L, Unreal. We're just going to show about 2.5 minutes of it. The whole video is 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. But just to give you a sense of what takes place. It starts with these big, broad establishing shots of the city, and we're in these hillside neighborhoods, and these kids are going down the hill first, and then they'll go back up the hill. Francis, you end with this. You one watches this, the whole video, and what's really a little bit absent here in this clip is the sense of these kids starting way up in the sort of most the poorest neighborhoods, way up on the side of the mountain, and then rolling these reels of film down, or it's really one, two.
No, it's basically like the crossing the whole valley of Kabul. I mean, it starts in one hill with a kid.
Oh, they go down one hill.
The kid actually playing with just doing the
hoop.
The with a child doing the kind of usual game of the art of rolling a wheel. It passes on to the kind of chase in between those two kids with a real film, and it goes from one side of the valley, which is downtown, crosses the river, which is a kind of like more modern city, and goes
more commercial
up,
area.
Goes up the opposite hill and looks back at the hill where the chase started.
Where they started.
That's more or less the route we followed.
So did this start with that, with you learning that story about the film archive? Because it's obviously it's related. It's the same time. It's related to the destruction of the Buddhas.
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, doing and doing, etc. It's always the same kind of like dualism. I mean, placing it back, as I said, when I was invited on the first trip, there was no formal invitation from Documenta, nor was it any commitment on my side to kind of produce a work in Afghanistan. I mean, I'm going to try to kind of, you know, encapsulate the making of a project as if, you know, taking that particular project as a study case. I mean, when you make a project, you've got like three main ingredients, three main elements. One being the idea, the other one being the kind of shape of the idea, the medium, and the third one being the occasion and the context. You know, what makes it round, and when possible, an interlocutor. So the idea is something that arrives much earlier. You know, that it's kind of just. It just happens, you know, and, and it's something that you've got in the back of your mind and that eventually acts a little bit like a preoccupation more than... So when I was invited to go to Afghanistan, I was in the same, in similar ways as I was back in 1996, questioning my relationship to sculpture with the ice piece. In, when was it, 2010, I was questioning my relation to film. You know, film in particular at the moment, you know, of this passage from analog to digital and the kind of immense proliferation of films on the web. So there was this kind of like preoccupation, if you want. So there I am, you know, walking in Kabul, etc. And it's a kind of, you know, the double, like a splitting of personality. On the one hand, you're immersed with, you know, an enormous amount of new information. You know, it's just like data coming in, coming in, coming in. Most of which are inaccessible. You know, you don't have the entry codes to the culture, the religion, the language, etc. So you're extremely alert, and on the other hand, you are still accompanied by that old preoccupation. You know, it's kind of the two things go in parallel. You know, of course, the preoccupation is maybe more hidden, but it's there. It's in the back of your mind. So meanwhile, you know, if I go back to the story of the particular project of the of this particular project, I mean, the medium had defined itself naturally through my notes. You know, the idea of film, the idea of moving image had turned into a real film, and, you know, the chain, the strip of film, physical strip of film.
Which is really resistant, by the way. I mean, it goes all the way down, right? I mean, it even goes through fire, basically. Or did you have to use more?
It breaks in fire. It broke.
It broke.
Yeah, that's the only place that made it. But, you know, getting back to my first visit, you know, I think more precisely it was the fact that the art of rolling a wheel is very common in Afghanistan. The kids are extremely good. So it suddenly clicked that maybe there was something to be pushed. It's this kind of like clash in between, you know, this new information and this former preoccupation, if you want, that lead you to a scenario. And I think that's, you know, you could question what is the relevance, I did certainly, of, you know, a Belgian artist living in Mexico asked to make a comment about the situation in Afghanistan. You know, it's just nonsense. But nevertheless, it this unlikely encounter triggered something, you know, in a chain of thoughts that was stuck, you know, if I go back to my premises, you know, an idea, two, a medium, three, a context, an occasion. There I kind of managed to materialize a context and eventually a reason to kind of materialize the work, because you also need to have the kind of like impulse and the conviction, if you want, mm-hmm. to make it happen. What preceded what isn't clear. I mean, you know, eventually later on, and that's to answer your question, I found out about the burning by the Taliban of the Afghan Film Archive, which, you know, were elements that confirmed that I was heading in the right direction, but to say where the actual artistic operation, like you call it, happened, is confused. You know, it's parallel.
So the displacement of this mm. historical information towards the end really does, in a way, mirror perhaps a little bit the process too behind the.
It did in that case because it became a local story, and that's where, you know, the mm-hmm. There's those two moments, you know, the local and the kind of more allegorical,
right?
You know,
right.
To replace the word export, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but what. What is not changing is that, you know, when you go to a place like Afghanistan, it's so rich that there's like, I would say, 20 different possible responses.
Yeah.
You know, there's always something to say, something to do, something to produce, but there's probably only one that fits within the narrative you've been developing before. And I mean, it is opportunistic from you know, an artist's point of view, but that's the one has to push.
Right.
It's the only one that makes sense. If you want mm-hmm. the other. Yeah, you can produce an interesting work of art, but if it doesn't somehow build on a narrative that precedes, it just falls into void.
That you've been building, but also that's been building up in the place that you're working. I mean, there's.
I think one feeds the other.
Yeah.
You know, one feeds the other. The context is an important element. You know, it's a little bit to kind of. It's easy to be critical of the kind of. Commissions and you know, in situ invitations where artists from anywhere nowadays are invited to produce something. It does happen that it triggers something that wouldn't have happened back in the studio or mm-hmm. back home, if you want. It's a different angle of looking at your own production and your own kind of food process.
I want to get, you know, so that we have some time for questions. I'm going to just skip through here, and I'll write about this some other time. But these are photographs by the American photographer Helen Levitt, both in New York, but also in Mexico City, where she also was looking at kids playing games. And Helen Levitt is particularly famous for her interest in children's graffiti. And in fact, the Surrealists were really interested in children's games. And you have a video upstairs of the kid kicking the bottle, you know, up mm-hmm. the street. And you've been working on a whole series of videos of kids doing games, mm-hmm. rock, paper, scissors, and playing with pinata, and different, not only in Mexico, but in mm-hmm. other places, right? So you're sort of collecting these little.
It's kind of an archive, but in a similar way as a. It's a series of very short documentaries that are on the website. And it's just another way of, you know, documenting a little bit in the kind of August Sander manner, you know, traditions, street traditions that are somewhat disappearing nowadays. Mm-hmm. So it's more than anything a register of children game pretty much wherever I come across them.
In the case, though, where what you didn't see in the opening of Real Unreal is after these location shots, what you do see is a kid first playing with this doing hoop rolling, which then, of course, translates into this scripted rolling that they're doing. And, you know, all I could, and I'm not, I'll just drop it on the table, I could really think about the parallel between these kids' games, the innocence of these kids' games, and their, you know, endless repetition, and often, you know, and often with a little bit of, you know, fighting. Not that they really appear in your thing. And the adult war games, of course, that are going on in the back or at the same time as mm-hmm. these kids' games. And, you know, This is amazing too. In Paradox of Praxis, you end. You're so distant and cool that you're just pushing this block of ice through the street, and then all of a sudden the camera does acknowledge the spectator who appear, and they're these kids. And it also the end of Real Unreal, the same thing that these kids have been performing or doing this thing in a sort of a distant way from the camera, or not really acknowledging the camera. And then at the end, too, towards the end, you let them kind of talk and engage and talk about film and the magic of film a little bit there. And I don't know if you really thought about this, but here you did not. That there's a very poetic
very similar
thing coming at the end. Anyway, something that maybe I'll write about. And this is something else, I think. Everybody familiar with the frame on the left? You mentioned it, actually, Lemorice's 1956 film, The Red Balloon, which, I mean, I remember seeing as a kid and just, being enthralled by, and the city really being his film being a lot about love of Paris, not only about the dreams and of children, but also the love of Paris. And one, I mean, maybe it's hard to have a love affair, say you love Kabul, but about an engagement with the city through this.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Poetry. Agreed. Anyway, I'm going to go back and watch The Red Balloon. So I want to wrap up then with this final film that he's just finished. Sometimes doing is not doing, and sometimes undoing is doing.
Sometimes doing is undoing, and sometimes undoing is doing.
Undoing is doing, right.
Yeah.
Did I still get it wrong? Sometimes doing is undoing, and sometimes undoing is doing.
Yeah.
Sorry. Okay. For the record. This is now on a more recent return. Was this last year or earlier this year?
This year.
And so you were embedded with these British troops?
Was embedded in...
How was your... You're with the British Army here?
I tried to with the U.S. Army, but they didn't take me.
They wouldn't take you?
So I moved on with the U.K.'s, and they did take me.
They did take you.
Yeah.
As a volunteer, embedded... with them.
What do you call a war artist?
Yeah.
Which is something anyone can apply to, by the way. You just have to submit and pass certain exams and not have a too heavy record of sorts. And then you're sent to a base in Helmand province in the south of Afghanistan, and from there you're moved from one base to another.
With them,
as they move.
Which is interesting because there's a long tradition of that embedded war. I mean, the war artists in World War II, Vietnam War II. So let's show, we're going to show pretty much, I think it starts here.
It's still vaguely in process. I mean, we just finished editing last week, so we're using you as a test screen.
Test. So I think we're just going to kind of let that sit, and maybe some of you have some questions, but I think we're you know, there's no, I don't have any grand wrap-up conclusion. I don't, do you?
No, I don't.
So I think we sort of putting that, this just to say one thing is that, the of course, the title here, Sometimes Doing is Undoing and Sometimes Undoing is Doing, echoes very explicitly this earlier piece of Sometimes Doing. Sometimes doing something leads to nothing, and sometimes doing nothing leads to something, these sort of paradoxes. Here now, though, you know, in a totally different arena. So, you know, we've gone on. So we thought perhaps some of you have some questions, specific questions for him about this piece or some of the other things. I don't know if there are any
comments.
Comments, questions? We have one here. We do have one here. Yes, because we're going to try to get outside of the museum. Here in blue?
Very outside. I'm wondering about the process with the people that appear in your videos. I guess you could get kids to roll circles all day long, but I'm especially interested in the last one with the two adult men and what kind of conversations you have with them, or mm-hmm. how that process.
I mean, this was an easy one because, I mean, the assembling, disassembling, reassembling the guns, no? I mean, it's something I witnessed more than asked them to do. I mean, it's a very customary exercise for someone who's got a gun to kind of disassemble it, reassemble it, check its kind of condition. So it's more like in my role there was much more of a recording something that was pre-existing than asking them to perform something. So it's. I mean, my intervention is to kind of frame it within a certain kind of like aphorism, you know, the doing and doing. But beyond that, it's as close as you could call it a found situation. I mean, the difficulty, if anything, was to make them accept to perform it in front of a camera, in particular in the case of the Mujahideen. But out of that, there was little intervention on my end in the making of the action itself, if you want. The real work was to get there. And to make it happen, not so much the action itself.
So here in the dark black shirt, and then we're going to go back in the back there. Here.
Oh, hi.
The 1-2, yeah. Okay. Sorry.
I want to go back to the first image where you're kind of identified yourself as a tourist. And I want to know if you can speak to that notion of a tourist, and if that's something you identify with, or if that's something that you carry with you when you're filming these films and making your work, mm-hmm. or if that's a way to really be subjectively objective about the situation. Mm-hmm. Identifying yourself that, firstly, it allows you to kind of take in everything. So this idea of the tourist, if you speak to that.
Yeah. I mean, the certainly when I... stand in 94 with that kind of panel saying tourist, it was a kind of it was as much an attempt of defining my situation as a question mark in terms of, you know, where, how involved did I want to be in Mexico. I was still questioning whether going back to Europe, It's you know, it's really oscillating in between leisure and work, observer and being observed, if you want. So it was a kind of turning point, and probably I would have forgotten about the piece itself as an action or as a kind of like situation if it wasn't, because it did mark, you know, a moment where I moved from a position of purely observing a place, and the works I was doing at the time were certainly much more inspired by the scenes I was seeing, to a position where I would interfere with the course of what I was witnessing, if you want. I mean, it took another 2 years to actually pass that into action. I mean, with the piece, the first video I did, which was of the sheep along the around the flag,
the flag pole
in 96. But it was, you know, personal kind of like a reflection on my own status and the perception of my neighborhood, of my persona, if you want, of this guy doing these funny acts around. Like, I mean, a lot of the actions of those early days are just an attempt of like both marking a territory, and it's not an accident I end up in this Centro Histórico. I mean, the historical center. It's a city within the city. I mean, the city was so massive when I, you know, in my first kind of like encounter, that I felt the need to reduce the territory to a 10 by 10 blocks kind of area. And from there on, a lot of the works produced back then were just an attempt to draw a territory and, you know, belong to the place, if you want. Like a, you know, I use sometimes the image of like a dog pissing to mark its territory. It's, a lot of it was just that. Mm-hmm. That changed over time, you know, and I think it's one of the questions we didn't have a chance to discuss. You asked me how I felt about the center of Mexico City today.
Being gentrified.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's one part which worries me is that it is much more like, you know, consumerist. You know, the culture of consumerism is much stronger than when I first arrived in Mexico. But beyond that, I've lost, if you want, that kind of like filter of the foreigner. I mean, I'm not saying I'm seeing it from within, but I'm in the building where I am. I'm probably the oldest tenant. You know, I've been there for, I mean, the former one, Santa Catarina, I've been there for 18 years. Most of the people there have been there for 2 or 3 years. They see me as part of the building. So it's a completely different perception of the place. Mm-hmm. When, if you were to transpose that in a place like Afghanistan, yeah, I mean, I suppose the term tourists, a cultural tourist or whatever, is still totally relevant. Why do I not repeat the same questioning is probably something I should question. I mean, the something I should kind of like examine, analyze, further analyze, if you want. But I think it's because, as I said, you know, you go there with a certain kind of like, you know, trajectory and narrative, and you just continue telling yourself the same story, you know, just building up a new episode. That's probably why I use the word opportunistic. You know, it is somewhat opportunist, to produce in those places, because at the end you're just, you know, still weaving the same larger kind of like story and narrative.
Yeah, tourists kind of, I mean, I think one of the, you know, you're poking fun of the tourists there standing between the plumber and the electrician, but, you know, the tourist is just kind of this observer, I think, and consumer of the exotic difference that he or she is buying. And I mean, at least those kids' lives are, you know, those neighborhoods are going to, you know, they're sort of, you enter into it, there's more of a transformative entry in, even if it is at the same time distanced. I don't know. There was a guy in the black t-shirt back
there. Yeah, that was a good man. It seems to me kind of interesting that earlier you start with your kind of dry, ironic, dip, narco tourist piece, and then we evolve towards these two successive films, both of which are kind of pregnant with danger. The first is kind of like comedy, a kind of Christo motif that could blow up at any minute, and then the second, quite literally, could blow up at any minute. I just wonder, were you drawn to Afghanistan because you think of yourself as a dangerous artist, or an artist in danger?
Or a species in danger? No, I mean, it wasn't my initiative to go there in the first place. I mean, I was invited there, and I was curious, obviously, and I was, you know,
tempted to, in the same kind of manner as it was tempting to go around the world with the money of people from San Diego, to kind of, you know, thanks to the Goethe Institute and to the city of Kassel, be able to discover a completely different culture. But probably there is a kind of, if I look back, there are certain contexts where I do happen to function better than others. I mean, I haven't been producing much in Cologne or in Munich, whereas I've been producing in places that are, say, in a state of tension. I think it just happens that it's somewhat easier for me to read those places because they're, as if we say that, you know, they're, the behaviors are more expressive, you know, the whole situation is much more like in Spanish it's after the deal.
Yeah, I don't want to push the comparison too much between you and you know, the Helen Levitt, this street photographer of the 40s, but she once told me, I said, why did you, you know, she lived in New York City her whole life, and she always worked in Spanish Harlem and the Lower East Side, particularly in the 30s and 40s, when those neighborhoods were rather, you know, she was an outsider as a, you know, Jewish girl from Brooklyn working in those neighborhoods. And I said, why did you go to those neighborhoods? She said, it's because that's where there was life on the street. You know, in the Upper East Side or in Greenwich Village, you know, that's where the kids were out in the street. That's where weird things were happening. That's where the drama was taking place. And that's where she could find, you know, something really rich. And I think it's there's something similar there, I think, between you and some of these more intense places, even Gibraltar or Israeli Palestine line or whatever.
But I mean, to answer your question, it is true that when I did the embed, there were probably two reasons. One was I had been going, you know, back and forth to Afghanistan for like two and a half years then, and you always, the presence of the whatever you call it, the ISAF, it's literally help, you know, foreign forces, say, is a very strange one because it's on the one hand invisible, you know, you don't see them, you know, you sometimes see a convoy passing through Kabul, like, you know, these state-of-the-art mega vehicles, everybody pulls on the side, they pass like 10, 12 vehicles, 3 minutes later everybody gets back on the street and chaos gets back into place. But you don't, there's no contact with them. So there was this kind of curiosity after so many visits, and I pretty much had a chance to travel all over Afghanistan to see what's happening inside those spaces. So that was one impulse. The other one was much more, and it's, you know, for the sake of looping with the beginning of this conversation, I did see it very much like the narco-tourism, you know, put myself in conditions where my ways of representing the situation would be altered, you know, you know, in the same way as the drug piece was an attempt to kind of escape some kind of reality. So there was a similar kind of, like, you know, most likely if there's anything coming out of the embed, it's going to be just a postcard, and it's about this kind of, you know, adrenaline trip.